This is the final session in the series called Poetry and Prayer. And the title of this series is, does anybody remember what the title of this session is? Well, it was one that Chris said she thought was a pretty title at lunch. And the name of it is The More Beautiful Question. It sounds weird enough for a session on poetry and prayer, doesn't it? Anybody got some responses to the title of this session? The More Beautiful Question. Where might that come from in the poet's universe of feeling, thought, language? What's the word you think of when you think of a question?
Answer.
Sure, an answer. And that's exactly where it does come from. It comes from a poet named E.E. Cummings. And E.E. Cummings puts it this way: always the beautiful answer, which asks the more beautiful question. Always the beautiful answer, which asks the more beautiful question. And I think that has a lot to do with what poetry is really all about, and maybe even with what life is all about. Because at its best, what the poet does, what poetry does, is reflect for us in some ways on our own life. So we always arrive at the beautiful answer in some form or another. And if we're really listening, if we're really open to what's going on, that answer itself asks the more beautiful question. And where do we go from that more beautiful question? To another answer. And where does that answer lead us? To another question, and on and on. So I think what Cummings is pointing to is that we aren't really ever satisfied. We aren't really ever finished. Things keep going on if we're alive, and we are, all of us, very much alive. And always, at the next turn of phrase, of thought, of the road, of whatever, you may be confronted with the more beautiful question. Maybe for years we go along with being satisfied with our beautiful answer. But if that answer doesn't itself contain some new seeds of life, or seeds of new life, whichever you want to put it, then it's not a good enough answer. In a sense, it's got to destroy itself by asking that question, so that the poet can write another poem, so that you can see another part of the country, or a different aspect of somebody whom you think you've known for a long time. That's why, as I see my mom and dad, I think that may be what keeps people married for a long time. They keep seeing different parts, new parts of themselves, of one another, of themselves and of one another, that they just hadn't noticed. So in a sense, the person you live with, the person who is close to you, is always asking you the more beautiful question. A lot of ways to think about that and to see how that phrase can be a part of us and of our lives. What are we doing, picking up the stragglers over here? Okay. You're welcome to come. Sit close, since we're almost one-on-one
for today. Everybody doesn't want to go on stage.
He doesn't want to. Well, you can never tell what might happen in this room, too. You can never tell what might happen in this room. Because poetry really is an oral art. You know, poetry should be performed. I'm not just going to let these words sit on the board there and just pretend, you know, that they are speaking to you. In a sense, they're speaking to you, but they don't have my voice, they don't have your voice to bring them to us, to bring them alive for us. So you're going to have to perform in here just as well. That lady's gone completely. She didn't want to stay for either one. Okay, I thought what I would do today, not knowing who was going to show up, whether some old friends or some new friends, I thought we would take a look at several poems. And I have two questions in mind, really. I'm always eager to find out what is a poem, what makes a poem. I point to this thing on the board and I say, hey guys, that's a poem. There are some signals which we've been trained to recognize that say to us, yeah, this is some kind of different kind of language. You could call it a poem. So that's one thing I'm interested in. But the title of the session is Poetry and Prayer. And I'm also very interested in what prayer is. And the third kind of more beautiful question that comes out of those two is, what do they have to do with one another? I think that they do have something to do with one another. And really, over the last 10 sessions, I've been exploring with a variety of people, what is it that connects poetry and prayer? How are they related to one another? How can they teach us about one another? So, like it or not, you've come to a final session. And that's my agenda for this final session. Let's take a look at some things that are called poems. Let's see whether we can say what makes those things poems. Let's think a little bit about what makes prayer for us. And then let's see whether there are some meshes, some things that we can learn about each one of those things. Okay, that's my point. Any questions, comments? Are you going to stay or going to go away? Okay, I have a poem on the board. And I would like to say this poem for you. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee, one clover and a bee, and reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few. Anybody know who wrote that? A lady named Emily Dickinson. And if you're interested in Emily Dickinson this coming week, Tom O'Connell, one of the people in that room, is going to be doing a whole series on Emily Dickinson. Not that I don't want you to come to mine, because we're going to have fun in mine too. But this book is the complete poems of Emily Dickinson. She wrote 1,776 of them. And she died 100 years ago this year, in 1886. And this is number 1,755. Took me that long to get this perfect poem. It might be a perfect poem. But it's a deceptive little poem. It looks like a simple little poem. But when we look at it, we'll see maybe some things that are going on underneath. So let me say it for you again. To make the prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee and reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few. Okay, what does she want us to, okay, all right. What kind of responses do you have to those few words? How does it make you feel? You can say anything you want to. Anything you say is right.
It makes you feel like you're in a field of probably red clover.
Oh, red clover. I like that. It's, okay, very good. Anybody got a different color for your clover there? This lady has really sensed it. Okay, what is your name, please?
Arlene Johnson.
Arlene? Arlene. Okay, Arlene's in the middle of that field of red clover. That's good. All right. Makes you feel like you're there. What other responses do you have to this little group of words here on the board?
I kind of feel myself taking off like in John Sharon's meditation yesterday afternoon, taking off to a prayer and just reverie.
Okay. You've picked out two words from the poem. Prairie and reverie.
Yes.
Okay, all right. How are those words alike? Prayer. Reverie. Now, I don't know any big intellectual connections here. Just give me simple stuff here. Poem's a simple poem. It uses words that most people know. What's the strangest word that we've got going in the poem?
Reverie.
Reverie. Okay, it's a strange word. It's an unusual word. And what about it? Twice. Okay? She's repeated that word reverie twice. What does that tell you if somebody says something to you twice? You're trying to make a point. Okay, trying to make an impression. It's saying, wow, you said it once, maybe it could slip by, but if they say it to you twice, it's important. And you better think about that little poem. Okay, now back to my original question. What's it like with prairie and reverie?
Would it be the quietness or anything?
The quietness, something simpler than that yet.
Expanse,
okay, something simpler than that yet.
The words themselves sound alike.
Sure, they sound alike. Prairie, reverie, mm-hmm. Don't they sound alike? Mm-hmm. Poets make capital on that word, on that sound-alike quality. Now, after we've recognized that there's a chime, if not a complete rhyme, between the two words, then we can start to think, why did she pick these two words? Maybe the expansiveness of the prairie is something that we feel, first of all. And reverie, well, maybe we should stop and say, what is a reverie? Or what is reverie? She doesn't use it as a reverie. You know, she uses it as just reverie.
Quiet, contemplative.
Okay, it's a sense of contemplation here. Anything else? Reverie. You're familiar with any other use of the word? I didn't ask that right. Could you use it for me in a sentence? Use the word, not the one that she's got on the board. A reverie. Oops, not a familiar word for you, huh?
I've seen it spelled
with an I-E. Yeah, R-E-V-E-R-I-E is also a spelling. And what does it mean in that spell? Same thing as this one, but what does it mean?
Kind of daydreaming.
Okay, exactly. That's the word I was looking for, a daydream, okay? Actually, the word comes from the French word, R-E-V-E, rev. And what does that mean? It means a dream, okay? So a reverie is a kind of a quiet, contemplative, daydreaming kind of mood. Do you let yourself get in those every once in a while? Do you find yourself falling into a reverie in which your memories and your past experiences and the people that you've known in the past just kind of are flowing very gently along with you? Okay. So, a rev, a dream, a memory, a recollection, a quiet kind of contemplative, flowing, daydreaming kind of period. Okay? So that's what she's asking us to think about in this poem. But that's not all. If I would say, okay, everybody instantly go into a reverie, right? Just instantly, rev. Would we all be thinking of the same thing? I hope not. I mean, God would be boring if we were all thinking of the same thing here. So, in order for the poet to get us to think something of the same things, what else does the poet have to do? To make a prairie, it doesn't just take reverie. What does it take?
A clover
and a bee. All right. Is that clover necessarily red?
No.
No. But where did it come from? How is it red? It's red in your reverie. Okay? What other kinds of clovers are in your reverie? What are the colors of clovers?
White.
There's a white clover. Okay. What's the difference between a red clover and a white clover?
One thing is it's a farmer's hay, the other one is a weed.
Okay. Do you know a difference?
The little red one has those little that you can pull each one out.
And suck them. Right. Okay. Good. Right. A sweet clover. Okay. A kind of a hay, something which is useful. Okay. And then there's another. Which one is the weed? The red clover is the weed?
No.
The white clover is the weed. The red clover. Make hay with that too. Okay. Why is hay the right kind of word to be using here? Because what are we really talking about? What's the fourth word in this poem? A prairie. Okay, a long, big expanse of things which, you know, get chopped down and hay is made out of them. All right. Now, what are the, I think of pink clover. I don't know, that may be a Louisiana or Texas thing, but I did see a pink clover growing up around here. Right. Maybe that's the same thing. That's the same thing, a red clover, okay. I always look pink. I never really understood the red part. Okay, a clover and one bee. All right, one bee. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. Why did she put those two together? What do clovers have to do with bees?
Pollination.
Right. There's a scientist speaking for us.
Sorry.
That's fine. And I think that is part of the association that she's got here. In some ways, it might be true. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. And one bee will be the being that will begin the whole, perhaps start someplace. I mean, it didn't start with a full-blown prairie. What?
Especially a love between the bee and the clover.
Okay, let's say an affinity. Okay, a mutual need, maybe. The clover will die if the bee doesn't take and pollinate it. Okay, the bee will die for, I don't know, why will the bee die?
No food.
No food, all right, no food. I'm not a farm girl. I may live in the Midwest now, but I'm definitely not a farm girl. Never was good in biology. All right, to make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. All right, kind of an ordinary little statement on the surface. But look at the second line of that poem. What does she say there? Let's say it all together.
One clover and a bee.
And a bee. All right, that's the second line. What's she doing here? She's repeating. She's absolutely repeating. Exactly?
No.
No, okay. How has she varied that?
She changed the one to a.
She changed the one to a. When she was starting off, she wanted to say it takes a clover. Now that she's thinking about it, repeating it over to herself, seeing the way the words feel in her mouth and in her mind, she says, one clover and a bee. Okay, so in one sense, we've got one bee, which is the important element in the first line, and then one clover gets to be the important element in the second line. Now, what's the effect of this repetition on you as a reader? Do you say, oh my goodness, the lady couldn't think of anything else to say, so she had to repeat it? What effect does this have on you as a reader? What does it make you do in your head?
Makes me see the clover, the bee. The things she repeated, I actually see it.
All right, you see it. Do you see it more clearly?
Mm-hmm.
You see it more clearly. Has she given you anything by which you can see it? I mean, has she described the clover or the bee any more clear? No. But she's kind of impressing this in your mind. Okay. Takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee. Look at it again, she's saying to us. I'm saying this to you. You look at it again. You make it your own in a different way. Okay. Is she finished at this point? How do we know she's not finished? Because what does her sentence end in? It ends in a comma. So that means, uh-oh, we got something else to come. And then the third line comes, and reverie, this long kind of daydreaming, reflective quality of the whole thing. And those three things together, you're missing, boy. You're welcome to leave anytime.
Storm the Bastille.
Those three things together, she's building up for us a sense of what it is to make a prayer and reverie. Then she's still not finished. She might have been finished, but then she's not. Because she says, thinking about it now, the reverie alone will do. Or maybe she's saying, the reverie alone will do, if bees are few. Okay, now what effect does that addition have on us? Why is the poem not finished? Poem could have been finished right here, but it's not. She goes on. What does this little addition due to the whole thing that's been happening to us in this poem.
Don't really need the prayer.
Don't really need the prairie? Is it the prairie that we don't need? To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee and a reverie. A reverie alone will do. Will do what?
We'll make the prairie.
We'll make the prairie. So we're still interested in making the prairie, but what is it that we don't need?
The physical description.
We don't actually need the clover and the bee. All we really need is reverie. Now she's doing something really crazy in these last two lines, I think. Okay. Now, where do the first three lines, well, the first two lines, where do they take place? It's a hard question, I know, but give me a simple answer. Where do they take place?
Outside.
Outside, exactly. They take place outside. They are external. There's something out there in the physical world. Where does the third line of the poem take place? Inside, in your head. Okay, so she's saying outside things are necessary to do this. This is still our object, to make a prairie. Okay? Outside things are necessary to do it, and inside things are necessary to do it. But what does she do in these two lines? What does she say is really necessary to make a prairie?
Just inside.
Just the inside. Just your what? What's that word? Your brain, your what?
Mind.
Your mind,
memory.
Your memory, your imagination. Sure, all those inside things. That's the really, really, really important thing. Okay. How many of you came up on the boat from Lake Chelan? On Lake Chelan, all of us did, huh? Okay, most of us. Some people came up by seaplane. A couple hiked in today, I saw. Now, is Lake Chelan right here? I don't think so. But is Lake Chelan right here? Sure it is. Sure it is, because what have I done? I have said the words Lake Chelan. And what have you done? That's right. You reveried them, okay? You dreamed it here. You made it happen in your mind, in your intellect, in your imagination, okay? You created images of Lake Chelan. Is your Lake Chelan the same as mine? No, mine was a beautiful day when we came up. The water was absolutely clear and blue and everything. If you came in yesterday, you had a lousy day, right? Was the water, what was the water like? It wasn't too bad. Okay, but it wasn't sparkling and glorious like it was for me with the sunshine. We each have a different Lake Chelan. We each have a different prairie. Okay? But the process, and the important part of the process, is the same thing. It's imagination, it's memory, it's daydreaming, it's recollection, it's reverie. So, what is this poem about, really?
About reverie.
Anybody else want to say it in a different way? What's it about?
Well, pardon me for being absolutely ridiculous, but for me it's about North Dakota. And the reason, because that is a prairie, and when I was heard this thing, I thought, in a reverie, I thought of the North Dakota prairie near dusk. And the clover and the bees. But not quite at dusk, but in a very quiet time, and a very contemplative time. And that's what made me think of that.
That's exactly, and that's right. North Dakota's a perfect answer to what this poem is all about. And also, in addition to that, this poem is about making your own poems. Making your own places. Recreating, if you, oh, it's a good word. Okay, I use the word recollection. And in a sense, in a sense, what that is to collect everything you thought about, you've experienced, and recollect it in this moment of imagination and reverie. It's also, what David's done, is recreating it, okay? He has created his prayer from that experience. Has anybody else ever seen a prayer? I don't think I've seen a prayer. You think I have seen a prayer?
I think most of us have.
Most of us have, but maybe we didn't know what the name of it was. Maybe the next time we come across something that's got clovers and bees in it, we'll say, oh, that must be a prayer. Look at that. Okay, so it's about North Dakota. It's about reverie. It's about recreating. What else is it about, in your own words? Poem doesn't belong to you, you know, unless you say what it's about and what it's composed of. Unless you say some of its words. What's it about?
It wouldn't be nature. Would that be?
It wouldn't be nature?
Would
it? Well, it would be. It's partly about nature, but it's about us in nature. It's not just about nature out there, but it's about how we see it, how we perceive it, understand it. Okay. I think it's about creation and recreation. I think it's about dreaming and imagination. I think it's about the way the words sound. Poems have different sounds sometimes than prose does. If I say to you, gee, I hope we have some hamburgers for supper tonight, have I said a poem to you?
Well, we can express our common wish.
But I haven't said a poem, okay. And we know somehow that there's a poem by the very sound of that poem, okay? Make a poem, let's say it all together. Can we make it all happen here? Okay, 1, 2, 3. To make a prayer, it takes a clover and one leaf. One clover and a leaf and a prairie. And to reverie alone with two, it needs a clue. Okay, belongs to you now. Belongs to you now. How does it sound? How has she made this poem sound like a poem? The easiest answer in the world, you learned it when you learned a poem the very first time. What does a poem do? It rhymes. Okay. It rhymes. Do we have a rhyme here?
B.
Sure we do. B and B, that's an exact rhyme. And
reverie
rhymes with B. Okay, now here's a reverie again in the middle of the line. Alone will do. Does this rhyme with anything? Oh, phew, of course it does, okay? So we've got three rhyming lines and two rhyming lines. Notice how neatly that corresponds to the outside poem and the inside poem. Okay, and notice, oh, I've never seen this before. What's the very last word of the poem? Oh, phew, no, that's wrong. I was thinking about do. I was hoping do was going to be the last word of the poem, which it's not. Because do is kind of what poets do. You know, they make things happen, and that's what I
was wondering about the meter of the poem. Could you talk about that? Because when you just hear the words, if you aren't paying attention to the rhyming quality, you can hear it sounds like a poem. And I don't quite pick up the meter.
The rhythm. I think this poem has more rhythm than meter. Meter is a kind of a technical word for poems. Usually, you think of a poem. Oh, my father tells me that every poem has to go da-dum, 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 da-dum. Okay, that's meter. That's measured language. Okay, this is more rhythm. This is more free-flowing, and it goes with the way we breathe, the way our voice can shape a phrase. I can't really talk about the rhythm or the meter of this one because it doesn't have any meter. I can't really do that.
So it just goes naturally by the way she's constructed it, by what she put in a line, what constitutes a line. Mm-hmm. It gives you your sense of rhythm right there. If she would organize it differently, you'd probably read it differently. The sound is good.
I was surprised that this first line was so long. I had to go check it in the book to see, because I have a lot of these poems in my head, but I don't have them visually. I don't know what they look like on the page. And it surprised me that all this was in the first line. Sounds to me like old Emily had a thought. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. And then after the thought, she said, oh, that sounds pretty good. I think I'll do some other things with it and make it into a poem. And then, in a sense, the poem really starts with what she meditates, how she embroiders on these this first part of the poem. One clover and me and reverie. And reverie alone will do if bees are few. See, she's working with kinds of twos in one here, and then this is three and ends up in two. That's what I'm doing there is accents, is kind of the stresses of the words in one. Okay, so this is a poem. What is a poem? What is a poem? Somebody has said a poem is a machine made of words.
It's a thought in rhyme.
It's a thought in rhyme. Okay, this poem rhymes. It's definitely a thought. Okay. Okay, it has some kind of rhyme to it. Not all poems rhyme. The next one I'm going to put on the board won't rhyme. Just to show you it doesn't have to be done that way. What else is a poem?
Think of beauty. And a joy forever.
Ah, oh, the beauty and the joy forever. Indeed, you, yes, absolutely. Edgar Allan Poe agrees with the lady about the rhyme and the rhythm. Edgar Allan Poe says, a poem is the rhythmic creation of beauty. Okay. Somebody else has said, a poem is language whose lines don't go all the way to the right-hand margin. That's kind of a description of sometimes what it looks like on the page, but not precisely there. Okay, what does a poem do, maybe I should ask? If it's this machine which is made of words, what does this machine do?
Transports you to others.
Okay, all right. It takes us away in place. It transports. Okay, brings us. And that's the very first thing that somebody said about this poem, remember? It puts you. It makes you feel like you're in the middle of a prayer, right? What else does a poem do?
It paints a picture.
Okay, surely. It paints a picture. Okay, although in this case we have a very, very small picture going on here. But it paints a picture, and then what does it do? It invites you to fill in what your picture looks like. Okay, maybe another way to say it is this one suggests an image for you. Other poems will be longer and more detailed and more visually oriented, and they will paint a picture for you. So it takes us to a different place. It gives us images, suggests images to look at. What else does it do?
It makes you feel.
Okay, makes us feel.
And think.
Makes us think. Does this poem really make you think? What did it make you think about?
Prayer.
A prayer. Okay, what else did it make you think about? It hasn't made you think about something else. I'm not a good teacher. Okay, it's made you think about reverie and those other words we use with association of that. Imagination and mind and insides and outsides and where you really are. Makes you think about one other thing, I think. And that is the thing I'd like to end with. Makes you kind of think of what's essential. Makes you think about what's necessary for something. What does it take to make a prairie? Well, reverie alone, if you don't have enough bees hanging around. Makes you think about what is essential. Okay. Somebody tell me what time it is, because I don't wear a watch. 25 minutes to 5, all right? Let's stop for a minute here, having done, you've done very well, by the way, with this poem. I congratulate you as a class. You've taken something that looks like it's nothing, and you've built up in your own ways and in your own words some very important things about what makes a poem happen and what does a poem do. Let's stop for a little bit here. And let me ask you the question. Does this have anything to do with what happens to us when we pray? Go because understanding how this poem works, what it does in you, connect with any understandings that we have about the activity of prayer.
Yeah, it does for me, because I can see how this poem cuts down to the very essentials of something. It's first it starts with the broad thing, the big thing, and then it says, hey, these things aren't necessary, you've got it up here. So I could say, if I want to pray, it takes reading the Bible first in a quiet place. But if I can't have these things, all I need is to search my heart and use my...
Okay, all right. It can, first of all, that's a really good way to put it. Sometimes what we need to make a pray, to make a prayer, that was not fair, was it? To make a prayer instead of a prayeree. To make a prayer, it takes a lot of Bible reading. It takes, what else does it take to make a prayer? Let's get as many things. Surely Emily Dickinson knew that there were many, many more things on a prairie than one clover would be, okay? Surely we know that there are many, many things that it takes to make a prayer. What are some of the things that it might take us to make a prayer?
The two words you have up there, recollection and recreating.
All right. And how do you? What do you mean by that?
Okay, if you're going to pray, it takes recollection for Thanksgiving, for the that part of your prayer. Be creating calls for what you would like to bring to the Lord and ask Him to do.
Okay, we collect our past experiences, don't we? When we try to sit down to pray, and then we recreate. Mm-hmm. We out of those past experiences, we see what our present need might be, and we bring this to the Lord in prayer. Okay, good. What other things does it take to make a prayer?
Memory, as far as time.
Okay, good. Can you have a quick reverie? Maybe, but usually not. Usually you don't have a quick daydream. If you get really into a daydream, it spreads out over a while. Somebody will say, hey, what you thinking about? And you'll say, oh my goodness. And you'll be way over here. Have you ever tried to unwind it to see where you started that made you think that thing that you were thinking right back there? Okay, so some sense of recollection in another sense. We need to collect ourselves up. Okay, we need to have some time to move into this reverie and dreaming in a way. What else? Now here's something we didn't talk about with this poem. Why did this poem get written at all? If I start off with always the more beautiful question, what's the question that this poem starts with? Okay, all right. And if you think about a poem as something that somebody might have said, okay? Somebody might have said to this writer, I've never seen a prairie. What's a prairie? And so her answer is, well, to make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. So there might be a need out there someplace in your lives, in our lives, that will make a prayer come. So in a sense, a prayer needs to have a need. A prayer needs to have a kind of question, the answer to which will be your prayer. And who knows the answer to that? This one. Anything else?
It's a collection of thoughts.
It's a collection of thoughts. Most of us don't have the gift of praying a single thought. I think that's something that Pastor Schramm was trying to teach us how to do a little bit better. A lot of times we have a very scattered, sense of, you know, there's something out there that I need, there's something that I'm feeling, and it's all over the place. Maybe what this poem can teach us is that we need to center, to focus, to get rid of what the junk is, and to get down to what the essential kind of thing is.
I think we should be in tune with God to pray.
Oh, right. I think we should be in tune with God. I pray for that in my life, to be in tune with God. What do you think the poet was in tune with when she wrote this poem?
The beauty of the earth.
Sure, the beauty of the earth. And what else? What other tunes were going on in her head? Remember that we talked about the outside and the inside. I knew I had it there someplace. What else was she in tune with? Her own imagination, her own power of imagination. And yes, so just as the poet needs to be in tune with the world out there, and in tune as well with her own creative and creating powers for the prayer, so do we need to be in tune with God in order to make a harmonious prayer. You ever tried to pray for something that you knew you shouldn't have? that doesn't sit well. It doesn't come out in a harmony at all. It comes out very discordant, I've found in my life anyway. This is not a discordant poem at all. This is a poem which has a rhythm, which has a measure, which sounds like something that should be said. And I think we know, too, when we pray honest poems, when we pray honest prayers, when we pray prayers that are in harmony, in tune with what we know to be part of God in our lives. Thank you for that. That was a very important thing to say. Is there anything else that the poem and the prayer might have in common? Teach us about
this. We visualize prayer, the prayer, what the prayer looked like. Mm-hmm. Maybe we try to sometimes visualize what God is to us.
I think that pleases God very much. I don't know. I understand. I'm not a theologian or any. I don't have any right to say that. But I think that that's a good connection here too. The poet needed to visualize this in order to make it real for herself and to give us the power to create this for ourselves. And I think if God gives us such a gift, if God lets us visualize his goodness in other people, in Jesus, then I think it's a pleasure to him to have us visualize what God is to us. And I think that changes a whole lot. I mean, does the prairie in autumn look like the prairie in spring? In winter? No, not at all. Okay. We say, yes, this is true, but this is not true in the wintertime. So maybe we need a winter prairie. She needs to do that. And maybe we need to see what God looks like to us at different times. And in different means, sure. Allow God his changes as he's given us the variety of seasons and people and words to express those things as well. Gee, y'all are so good. Teaching me all kinds of things. Anything else?
Well,
I'm going to erase this one and put another one on the board, just for the pleasure of it, because we have about 10 minutes? Okay, all right, let me put another one on the board, and you can talk if you want to, but I'm going to be quiet, because
you
give me a lot to think about.
Did she know she had that much in there when she wrote it? Did she know she had that much in there when she
wrote it? Oh, somebody always asks that question. Let me put it to you this way. I try to write poetry myself. And there is a lot that I put into my poems, out of which I make my poems, that I do know what's going on. I make sure that it's there. But there's always something that somebody will come along and say, hey, this does this, this sounds like such and so or whatever, and I'll say, gosh, that's really good. Now, does that mean that I didn't, you know, that it's not in the poem because I didn't put it there? That's not true at all. The poet always writes more than he or she knows. And if he doesn't, then it's not a poem. Then it's not a real poem. It's not a really zingy one that kind of goes off the page. So it's perfectly all right that she didn't know what was there. It's us. It's our poem. We remake the poem. We create it. And I think she'd be, if Emily Dickinson could walk through that door, I think she'd be real happy with what we were doing with her poem. Yeah. Question? Or you were just batting at the fly?
That's an occupation here.
Okay. Here's another one. Occasions. And here's a poem then. In the land of evening, blue dragonfly is skimming over the water. Only his tail touches as his wings flap and rustle. In the land of evening, blue dragonfly is skimming over the water. Only his tail touches as his wings flap and rustle.
Sure, see the picture.
Okay, you can see the picture. We can see distinct images of this picture, can't we? What specific things is the poet showing us here?
Evening.
Well, I don't know. Could that be, that could be a brilliant colored evening, or it could be a gray evening, or whatever. We know some things about it, but not many things about it. What else do we see specifically?
The dragonfly.
Okay, we see the dragonfly, and even more than that, what? The blue dragonfly. What other colors are dragonflies?
Green.
Green, and what else? Any brown ones? Up in this part of the country, we used to have brown ones as well. Kind of a dull, grayish, brownish color. And have you ever seen a red one? They bite real bad. The green ones you could never catch. They were so flickery away really quick. The blue ones were a little quieter. The gray-brown ones were not good at all, but the red ones really bit. I caught many a dragonfly when I was a little girl down in the swamplands of Louisiana. Okay, so a blue dragonfly.
Well, it has the image of calm water.
Hmm?
It has the image of calm water.
Okay, calm water, calm water. How do we know that?
Because if he wasn't calm water, he wouldn't be flying close enough for his tail to touch.
Okay. Now, that's not in the poem, but it's implied in the poem. What you're doing there is wonderful, because you are not, this is kind of the text. This is what is given in the poem. But we are inside the poem now. We are seeing something that the poet is suggesting to us, but not saying to us directly in there. What else do we see directly or hear directly? How about those lovely two words, last, the flap and the rustle of the wings, okay? Those are not visual images, mainly. Well, maybe the flap is a visual image, but the rustle is an auditory image. We hear a rustle. We don't see a rustle.
Buzzing over the water.
Okay, a buzz. Yeah, maybe that's what we hear. But what we're looking at is the leaves rustling. Okay, does this poem have anything in common with the poem that we just looked at, with the prairie poem?
That's 5 lines.
Actually, it doesn't. These go on this first line. Does it have anything in common? Are they doing the same kinds of things in those two poems?
Both creating visual images.
Right, creating visual images. What else?
Thinking of essential elements.
Okay.
Like, both have an insight on it.
Yeah, okay, let's talk about the essential elements here.
Like it had the other had the prairie, this gives you the water.
All right.
And then you have the bee, this has got the dragonfly.
And what else does it give? It has evening as well.
Yeah.
I think that's an important one. And we see that dragonfly in a particular kind of movement. Vision that movement for yourselves, if you will. What kind of movement is going on here? What kinds of movements do dragonflies make?
Flowers.
Okay, they can swoop. They can go to flowers. What else? They can skim, okay. What's this one doing? Is he skimming? His tail's touching. What else can dragonflies do, though? Can't they hover? They can swoop, they can skim, they can dart, they can also hover. Okay, and that's what this one's doing. Only his tail is touching. My tail is out back that way, in case you can't. As his wings flap and rustle. This is a moment, an absolutely instant, still kind of moment. And these words have caught that moment for us. And I think that's the really important thing. What happens when people like those who are trooping by right now still go on the stage, what they do is show us movement. What the poet can do is show us stillness. Catch an instant and show us stillness. Sometimes our prayer needs movement in that way. Sometimes it needs to have the stillness of the dragonfly as only his wings flap and rustle. Okay. It has an insight, you tell us. What kind of insect?
I said both insects.
Oh, they have both insects. Oh, I see. I thought you were telling us an insight of some kind.
The insects.
Insects, all right. I'll go with insects. That's a good place to start there. What difference does that make that they have both, that these are insects? I don't know what to do with that, as a matter of fact. I don't know that it's really important that they are both insects. I do.
You said what do they have in common? Mm-hmm.
That's okay, and that's right, and they do. And I was going one step farther, and I shouldn't have been. But I do know why something is important that there are both insects in this poem. They're both small insects. What does this imply for the fact that somebody is writing about these things? You have to pay some attention. You have to. You just can't kind of look only at the big things. There's some attention that needs to be paid to the small things as well. I think that's got a lot to do with prayer as well. This kind of attention. The word attention comes from two words in Latin, ad tendere, and that means to stretch toward. And so when you pay attention to something, you literally stretch toward it, or you see that it is stretching toward you in some way. And I think that's something that's essential about the poem as well, that we pay attention, we give attention to something. And our reward is to see things in a different way, to see things that ordinarily you would have missed, and I think to become more human in the process of doing so. Okay, well, I'm about talked out. Although I don't know what to do with all of this silence. I feel the background. Hi, I didn't even see you guys up there. Does anybody want to say something before the session is finished? Ask a question, make a comment, make a poem.
What more do you see or feel of that? Because I could read through it and probably just skip on to the next page thinking, oh, that was very pretty, but it didn't touch me.
Mm-hmm. What more do I see in it?
It only becomes meaningful, particularly in that insect that she brought up, because I was thinking of insects being so insignificant, I don't want to have much to do with them. Anything we squash them, go on to what's important in life. Until you were pointing out that the little things are what's really perhaps important in life.
And the beauty of the little things, yeah. that we can pass by.
But then that gives this one meaning to me, or otherwise I would just say, oh, this is a very pretty little thing. Like I'm picking up a pretty little stone and putting it down again.
Right. I think the key to really understanding poetry and really understanding prayer is to put yourself into it as much as possible, to enter its world. There is a dynamic thing going on here. It invites us to come into it, to take part in the process that's going on. I mean, we could have sat and looked from the outside at clovers and bees and dragonflies and all of that. But the minute that it invites you in with this word reverie, recollection, something that you bring to it and make from it, the minute that it invites you in, what caught me in this was flap and rustle. Only his tail touches the water, and then I finally heard it as his wings flap and rustle. The vitality of life for that dragonfly is what brought me into that poem. See, and I think that the same thing is true for prayer as well. That there's a dynamic life that God is intending for us, God is calling us to. And something has to kind of invite us in, trip us in, catch our attention, make us pay more attention to it. And that's the key to seeing, for me anyway, what's going on in poem. I like to talk about the poem as having white space in it. Things that aren't all filled up. You know how when you paint a picture, if you fill that whole canvas with busy stuff going on and on and on, there's not going to be any room for your audience. But if you leave some spaces in the poem which invite the reader to come in, it's like what David did with the, what did you call
calm
it?
Water.
With the calm, okay, the calm water. Now that made the poem his, really. You know, he had a part in creating it. And if we can do that, then we are much more perceptive, attentive, respectful readers of nature and poems. And I would even say of God's words for us.
What's that under water?
Well, thank you very much. This has been fun. I've enjoyed it. And even if the poets didn't know that they put everything in there, we have something to teach them. I once read that no word that we say is ever kind of just lost. They're all out there in space someplace. So, Emily Dickinson, if you're out there, you listen to what we've taught you about your poem today.
Thank you.
Thank you.